That's the Animals and House of the Rising Sun play, because we're talking about animals, animals in the city with my guest today, Tom Almaroth-Williams. Is that how you pronounce it, Tom?
That's right, yes, yes.
It is a fabulous name.
That's very kind. Mouthful, fabulous name, I'll take any credit. No, it's great. And it is sort of relevant, I suppose, to how I got into 18th century history in the first place, just by doing family history research, which obviously lots of people love doing, and just exploring the name. So the Almaroth comes from Hermann Almaroth, who was a German sugar baker who emigrated to London, set up a sugar refinery in Whitechapel, and so I just got fascinated in him, and it sort of exploded from there over the years, really.
So was it an Almaroth marrying a Williams? Is that
it? Was, well, actually, I was born just plain old Tom Williams, but the name is so rare, particularly in Britain, that I wanted to keep it going. So so I've given myself this. When I have to pay the electricity bill and I have to read my name out over the phone, it's not the most practical thing, but I love it too. It's a great name.
Well, nice to have you here. You're here to talk about the talk that you're giving for the Festival of Ideas on Wednesday, Animals in the City, and it's based on your book, City of Beasts. So tell me about the book. What's the book about?
Sure. Well, it's been going for a long time. Back in 2005, I was rudely awakened by 30 horses walking down the street outside my flat in North London in Kentish Town, and the sound of their hooves started making the windows rattle of this little Victorian flat that I was in. And I looked outside the window, and these horses were going back to their army barracks at the time, but it was still very rare to see them. And it was such a shocking experience, sort of 5 o'clock in the morning, the sight and the sound, the steam coming out of their nostrils. It just got me thinking on a very basic level about what it would have been like when that kind of thing was normal to be expected. And I kind of thought that historians would have been all over this. I thought there would have been so many books, and I was picking up these giant tomes about London history, the popular histories and the academic ones, and you look through the index and you don't find any horses, or there's a couple of pages. And these animals just seem to be hiding in plain sight. It was, you start looking through the paintings and prints from the period, then you go into the archives and you just find that they're everywhere. And, you know, now my attic is just full of notes, you know, only some of which ended up in the book. It's just a huge, huge forgotten story, really.
So it's about the life of animals and how it connected with the city. And would there have been a time where seeing several horses walking down the street was pretty normal?
I mean, just to give you a feel for the numbers, so you had, by 1800, you'd got about 30,000 horses working in the city. Double that if you want to include all the aristocrats' fancy horses pulling carriages and riding horses. Then you've got, every week, you've got 30,000 cattle and sheep being brought through the city every single week to be sold in Smithfield Market. You've got 8,000 milk cows being kept permanently in the city. Some estimates said that there were 100,000 dogs in the city around this time as well. So you couldn't move for these animals. There was a huge amount of pig keeping going on as well. So it dominated every part of life, not just for the poor. I think we've got this perception that, for example, urban farming is sort of Victorian slums and poverty and disease. That wasn't the case in this period. Animals are absolutely crucial to the success of the city. Of course, they brought huge nuisance and filth and smells and all the rest of it, which we can talk about. But it's impossible to understand how London becomes the world's most powerful and wealthy city in this period unless you account for the influence of the animals. In the past, when historians have considered animals in London's history, they've tended to portray them as victims. And of course, I don't shy away from that in the book. There was horrendous cruelty suffered by these animals. But we've forgotten how much they contributed. And you can't understand things like the Industrial Revolution if you don't recognise that. And you can't understand the way that people behaved and what their lives were like in this environment unless you consider their relationships with animals.
And you say London, would that have been true of other cities as well?
It certainly was true of other cities. The strange thing with London is that you might expect that because it's the biggest city and it's got the biggest human population, it's the wealthiest, in many ways the most organised, you would think that London would have pushed the animals out, and historians have got that wrong over the years. Actually, it was the opposite. Animals would have been more prevalent and more influential in London. Other cities like Manchester and Liverpool, that you might think of as having more animals and being less organised because they were less wealthy, they were actually much more efficient at pushing animals out. So they decided in the late 18th century century that it wasn't a great idea to have thousands of cattle and sheep roaming through the city going to market. So they pushed them out to satellite towns. London just carries on, and the trade gets bigger and bigger, and the casualties get more and more. Paris banned inner-city livestock marketing in the 14th century. London only stops it in 1855, by which point the chaos is just beyond anything you can imagine.
Yes, chaos. I mean, I can't imagine all those animals and people in one place. What would it have felt like and smelt like?
Yeah. I mean, the crazy thing was is it was every Monday and Friday this happened, and Monday, as it is today, is sort of the busiest work day, the biggest day in the city of London when all the bankers and merchants are filling up and doing their deals. So it causes maximum chaos. The livestock are driven in very early in the morning, so that's not too bad. But when they're driven back out again to then be slaughtered throughout the city, you've got everyone going about their work and no one escapes it. Even very wealthy ladies doing their shopping in the West End can still get caught out and end up being tossed in the air by an enraged bullock. And the chaos was horrendous, and there were regular injuries and regular deaths, and the newspaper reports, which are all in the book, and I'll talk about this in the talk, are really, really spine-chilling. I mean, some of your listeners will be still having breakfast or a cup of tea, and so I won't ruin that, but, you know, there's some really blood-curdling incidents. The cattle would toss people, they would gore people, the injuries were really, really terrible.
Well, presumably the animals were frightened, in fairness.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the thing that really comes through the book, and something that I want to bring out in the talk is about attitudes to animals. We tend to sort of look down on our ancestors as being kind of cruel to animals, and haven't we progressed so far? What I found in my research was the situation was much more complicated, and you've just got this impossible situation, really, where you've got very poor men who are being employed, being paid very little money to drive these animals through a very difficult urban environment. And then, as you say, you've got these poor animals who are not equipped to deal with the noise, the sound of industry, of vehicles coming towards them. Unfortunately, this also happened. Passers-by would tease them. And that's one thing that really comes through. I mean, when I one of my hobbies in the summer is to see how people react to the Cambridge cows and to see the sort of nervousness. I mean, even though that, you know, it's a cyclical thing that we have them, people are still very nervous to get close to them. In Georgian London, people were so familiar with them. You would have women steal milk from cows direct from the udder in summer. You would have children playing in cow yards, and unfortunately that could end up being deadly. You would have drunks sleeping in haylofts above the cows, people stealing pigs, etc. And also teasing horses, setting off fireworks deliberately near them, putting peas in their ears. And there was a very popular sport called bullock hunting, where you would strike a skittish-looking young bullock in the busiest street you could find, and just enjoy the chaos that would then ensue. And these hunts could go on for 2 hours until the butcher or the drover could finally get hold of the animal and take them to the slaughterhouse. So we've got a real mixture of confidence, cruelty, but also great affection, which has sort of been lost in the story.
Yes, I mean, tell us about the affection.
Yeah, let's brighten up people's day somewhat. I mean, one, you know, slight. So it is unfortunately true that horses were regularly worked to death in the city. So there is an economic view of horses, but there's also huge reverence for these animals, even for the sort of lowliest working animal. If the lowliest working animal is helping you to pull off this sort of new technology by powering this new technology, then you might put a picture of that horse on your business card because you appreciate its work so much. But also you've got people investing huge sums in riding horses and carriage horses, and you'd have to make sure that your carriage horses had matching coloured hair on their feet, or this sort of thing. So there was a fashionable element to it. But you find, for example, city boy merchants, whenever they get free time out of their desk job, they'll rush out to the stables to go and see their favourite horse that they're paying huge sums to look after, and then they'll ride them out to what were then scenic, lovely destinations like Romford and Tottenham, sort of unspoilt rural spots. And you just get little glimmers of affection. You know, these men, they're very busy, but they go to see their horses to make sure that they're being well looked after. And there's one guy called Silas Neville, who's a bachelor trying to make his way in the world. And he doesn't have a lot of money, but he spends a lot of time buying this horse he loves very much. And then he falls into debt. And in his diary years later, he writes that he rode home on this horse for the last time and cried all over its neck because he knew it was the last time he'd be able to ride this horse. Well, you know, this is not the language of a people or a culture that don't love their animals. And I think we've been tempted to think that the Victorians somehow invented affection for animals, and medieval historians will tell you that's nonsense. I'll say that that's nonsense as well. You know, the fact that the word pet is sort of a later invention doesn't mean that kind of affection for cats and dogs and horses and other animals, even pigs, wasn't there.
So why did this stop then? Was it the motor car?
Yes, I mean, it actually goes on, the horse numbers keep increasing after my period. I mean, it sort of would be a fair question, you know, why did I focus on Georgian London? If I wanted more animals, I could have written about Victorian London. It really, it's Georgian London because the variety of animals is more there. So, for example, Smithfield Market closed down in 1855 for livestock and reopens in suburban Islington. But the numbers keep increasing, you know, right up to the turn of the 20th century, you know, by which point you've obviously got omnibuses and taxi cabs being pulled by horses in huge numbers, but also the coal and sort of modernity and technological advancement just encourages more horses because you're bringing more coal into the city, which then needs to be transported around the city. So yeah, the change has come very late. And when I've been giving these talks, you know, particularly in London, I've had people coming up to me. I mean, not old people at all. People in their sort of 60s and 70s coming up to me saying, oh, "I still remember when the rag and bow man used to come past.
Oh,
or
I do.
You know, the brewery." So that's lovely, and I'm really glad that the book's happening now while these memories are still sort of fresh and can still be shared.
I remember the Rag and Bone Man, definitely. And I live on a street where there used to be a dairy, and the horse would pull the cart with the churns, yeah, on, I suppose.
Yeah.
So Cambridge, of course, you mentioned the cows. We've got cows in the city. I suppose that's quite unusual these days, is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is unusual. And obviously, I was with friends the other day, and there was sort of German couple that were talking about it. And obviously, it's every nation that comes to live in Cambridge sort of experiences that in a different way. But I think it surprises everyone. I think it surprises people born in Britain, and it surprises people coming in. As I say, I do find it really fascinating to see how people react to the cattle, and I sort of think back to the confidence of people a couple of hundred years ago. And of course, the difference in numbers, I mean, your listeners might correct me on this, but a couple of years ago, a journalist did a count of this, and there were sort of somewhere between 100 and 150 cows in Cambridge. As I say, there were 8,000 in London at any one time, and add on to that all the ones coming in for the Smithfield livestock trade as well. So we're in a different league in terms of numbers. But I do love seeing the tweets of people cycling and being blocked by the cows and sort of politely waiting for them. And it's just interesting as well. I mean, I think people have become very affectionate now about those Cambridge cows. You can't really imagine life without them. This idea for this book was very much born out of living in London, but I finished writing the book for the last couple of years living in Cambridge. And when I moved out of London to Cambridge, I just found it the most rural place. It was shocking. I mean, I don't feel like that now at all. But at the time, you know, people had their allotments and there were chickens in the garden next door. I just felt much more in tune with nature. So I'm really glad, actually, that I got to finish the book here and not just London. I think it brought different perspectives to it.
And is there evidence of this, of these animals in the city, in our language, in the culture, in the way we behave in the city? Is there still a legacy?
Yeah, I mean, so you can see it in lots of street names. If you go near to Smithfield Market, you'll still see streets like Cow Cross, and you'll see that in other cities as well. You'll also see references to, I mean, my first degree was in Durham, and there was a street called Flesher Gate, which is all to do with, you know, as you can imagine, sort of butchering processes. But I think my favourite one in terms of the language is going back to these horrendous accidents. So one of the things that happened when cattle were driven out of Smithfield, people would be doing their shopping in places like Ludgate Hill and Holborn, and to escape the cattle, they would run into shops, which would cause it would really annoy the shopkeepers. But sometimes the cattle would then follow them in, either by barging through the door or smashing into the shop. And these were very fancy shops. These were jewellery shops and clothes shops and china shops.
Oh, I wondered if you were going there. Yes.
And so by around 1800, you're starting to see bull in a china shop. The first reference I found is in an advert for shoe polish, and it's just a sort of very random reference to bull in a china shop there. But you start seeing it in the newspapers. And by this point, calls for Smithfield Market to be shut down are at their peak, really. It takes another 50 years for it actually to happen. But it's no coincidence that phrase enters common parlance when people are most annoyed by the Smithfield trade.
Oh, that's fascinating. There really were bulls in china shops.
Absolutely.
So your talk is on Wednesday, 6 to 7pm at Animals in the City. What kind of things will you be covering?
Well, so it's an unusual one in a sense, because I'm going to be drawing these. Usually I'm giving talks in London and, you know, drawing references to the sort of surroundings. But this one's going to be much more focused on the attitudes. And it's, in a way, it's the most risky part of the book to open up to discussion. There are two camps of thought now about attitudes to animals. Some people have argued initially that in the late 18th century you have this flowering of new sympathetic attitudes to animals. More recently, historians, including myself, have disputed that. There just isn't the evidence that that kind of change in attitudes permeated through society much further than your kind of clergymen or sort of aristocrats, in a way the people who could afford to have these opinions. My book and the talk is really about the people who were living and working with animals up close and their dung bespattered interactions, and I'm most interested in knowing what they felt like. What were their lives like with these animals? Were they just uneducated, cruel, barbarous, drunk people in their day jobs, or were their lives just incredibly difficult? And did these people and these animals share an experience that we need to understand? And I think we need to understand it, because let's face it, we've got our own problems today with things like meat traceability, with animal welfare, with eco-crisis and what we eat. So my talk is not going to ask anyone to give up meat or anything like that, but it is going to question whether we can feel as smug with ourselves as we sometimes are, and ask us to think about what our ancestors went through and what the animals went through with them.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. So that's Wednesday, 6 to 7pm, if you're interested. festivalofideas.cam.ac.uk. But can you just turn up on the door?
I think... I'm actually not sure. Now yeah. I'm going to get myself in trouble.
I was just a turn up on the door.
It's a big venue. I think that would probably be okay. I'll get in trouble now with people, but... Please come. We'd love to see.
And your book, City of Beasts, published by?
It's published by Manchester University Press.
Lovely. Thank you for joining me today. And good luck for Wednesday, Tom.
Thank you.